Okay, good afternoon. My name is Rena Basser. I'm a historian and a number of other things. I have to make an important announcement. I'm breaking with tradition, both my own and everybody else's. I am not giving a handout. All right? Take your own notes, use your own paper, and don't bother me, because I would have done it, but I planned this a little bit too late, so that's really my excuse. But anyways, I think we'll suffice, we'll survive it. My topic is the Spanish Inquisition and how moving from a terrible situation in Spain, where Jews had their own tradition of living there since the first destruction of the temple, they had a tradition of that, to having to leave and leave in a terrible way. And what I want to show in this journey is how people transformed, completely altered what they had to do and how they did it. And actually, because of that, we probably have a much richer Judaism today. We often don't talk about the Spanish Inquisition, but many other disasters are spoken about on Tisha B'Av, so I wanted to talk about this today. It's an interest of mine. I love reading Kabbalah. I love reading Zohar. I love reading Kedushas Levi of Berdichev, which we're going to read today. I'm going to start off, though, with a story. And the story is not my own, although I love those stories, hearing the rabbi before me. But I'm going to tell you something from the famous Baal Shem Tov. He was in the habit of praying Musaf at great length, Friday afternoon. All right, it's going on, and he elongates everything. It took him a full hour, where it would not take most people a full hour. But his disciples, who finished much quicker, were growing very impatient and bored. So one Shabbat, they decided to go home and have a l'chaim while he prayed. He doesn't need us. We don't need him. We're done. We're going. Finishing their prayers, they tiptoed out from the shul one by one. As the last disciple was leaving, the Baal Shem unexpectedly took three steps backwards and three steps forwards, finishing the end of his prayer. It was long before the usual time, and the shocked disciples hastily called the others back. All stood looking at their Rebbe in astonishment, and he explained. You see, he says to them, when I pray, I ascend a ladder to the divine throne, the ladder built of your presence in prayer. This morning, halfway through the ascent, I felt my ladder crumbling and had no choice but to finish my prayer. The Baal Shem in this story, this is an incredible story. He needed them. He needed the disciples around him to pray. The individual in that story, the individual's strength and power, has broken through. We now see in the time of the Baal Shem, in the 17th century, that Judaism takes a giant leap forward, a leap into the individual. Pre-Freud, pre-Enlightenment, Judaism moves into the individual. And I'm going to take you on a journey that will show you how it didn't start off that way, but it ends off 200 years later, in the journey of the individual soul. And that is very unusual in religion and in the history of religion. First, history. The expulsion from Spain, 1492, everybody knows it, fine. But really, why? Typically, people don't like, in the ancient world or in the medieval world, to get rid of a tax base. They don't like to get rid of people. They give them taxes, they give them, or they're farmers. They don't often like to expel. There were certain Jewish expulsions in England and in other places, in France, and of course in Spain. But honestly, it's a very rare move, and actually a very bad financial move. Because here you have a people like the Jews sitting in Spain, who became bureaucrats of the highest order. The Jews are always good at being bureaucrats. Think about our friend Mordechai in the Megillat Esther. He's a bureaucrat. He was involved in the government. Why do you think he could overhear all those things he overheard? Next Purim, when you're reading, think historically. How did that Mordechai get in there? You don't just walk into gates. Gates are closed, and there's a lot of security, more than here, although I liked it, thank you, Jay. But the fact is that Jews were good bureaucrats. They became educated in the languages in which they were very, very quickly. Quicker than anyone actually anticipated. Nobody understands it, but that's what they did. So here it is. Ferdinand and Isabella, in 1492, decide to expel the Jews. Actually, nobody knows why. No historian knows why. There's a couple of pieces of literature, which I'm going to read to you in part, but nobody can figure out really why they would get rid of the Jews. They were trying to do many, many things prior to 1492. We know, take a step back into Spain first. Spain was not Christian when it became, let's call it, great. Spain was Muslim. Spain was divided into two. The north was Christian, and the south was Muslim. And the Jews were doing very well. Whether or not they were there, I don't know, 1,000 years, 400 years, 300 years, it doesn't matter. They had a very good place in Spain, and they did very, very well, and they really contributed to the Spanish economy, culture, livelihood, intellect, arts, everything else. Okay. But the northern group, meaning the Christians, were not really happy with the Jewish presence or with the Arab presence, and they started to take over. This is the time, of course, of Christopher Columbus. Ferdinand and Isabella supported his travels. So here it is. They want to expand. They're on an expansion mission. And they want people to become like them. This is very common. When a conqueror goes in, he really doesn't care if you fake it. You know what I mean? He says, you be like me. And if you're not really like me, and if you're just pretending, it's okay. That's what basically the Muslims did in the 8th century, 7th century. They took over the whole world. They conquered the world from Spain to the Gobi Desert, wide swaths of land. And they said, we really don't want you to be like yourselves. We want you to be Arabic. But you know what? We'll put up with you. Just pretend that you love us. Pretend that you think we're great and dominant. I'm making it sound funny, but it's their approach. It was an excellent financial approach. It was brilliant because everybody who they took over, which were many, many different kinds of people, said, you know what? We could stay here. We don't have to run away. They're not bad to us. They're helpful to us, and they're not going to kick us out and make us be Muslim. Even though there were various rules, right? You couldn't, for instance, the rules that come up in the Quran said that if you were going to build a shul, it couldn't be as high as the mosque. Or if a Muslim important person is on horseback and so are you. You had to get off and kind of bow to him. Okay, all these things are small. They even said that the Jews were supposed to wear distinctive clothing. You can guess what color it's going to be. Yellow. They were supposed to wear yellow scarves. Did they wear these yellow scarves? We don't really know. All we know is it's written in the Quran and all of the accompanying literature. So they wanted people to be distinctive, but they didn't really mind so much about keeping your individuality. But the Christians were different. They wanted the world to become Christian. They were missionaries. And that is a very unusual approach in the history of the world, because what it does is make people leave either on their own or leave the country through expulsion, which is what happened. And that is not good economic sense. So I'm going to read to you an account from a Jewish person who wrote about the expulsion in Spain. And it goes like this. In the year 1492, in the days of King Ferdinand, the Lord visited the remnant of his people a second time and exiled them. After the king had captured the city of Granada from the Moors and had surrendered to him on the 7th, that's the second day of January, he ordered the expulsion of all the Jews in all parts of the kingdom, in the kingdoms of, and now they have a long list, Castile, Catalonia, Aragon, Galicia, Majorca, Minorca, the Basque, okay. Even before the queen had expelled them from the kingdom of Andalusia. The king gave them 3 months' time in which to leave. It was announced in public in every city on the 1st of May, which happened to be the 19th day of the Omer, and the term ended on the day before, you got it? The 9th of Av. They were supposed to leave Spain on the 8th of Av. And he goes on and on and says that we didn't want to, we shouldn't, it was horrible, it was awful, okay, and so on. And then he ends up by saying, how did we leave? We're leaving on the 8th of Av. We have 3 months in which to leave. 3 months. We're going to talk about those 3 months. Why 3 months? What was in the mind of the Spanish that they needed them to leave in 3 months? And think about how fast you had to sell your house and belongings because you couldn't take them with you. This account ends in the following note. Part of the exiled Spaniards went to Turkey. Some of them were thrown into the sea and drowned. But those who arrived in Turkey were received kindly by the Sultan, as they were artisans. The king in Turkey lent them money and settled many of them on an island and gave them fields and estates. This historical part is very interesting. The Sultan of Turkey, who was ruling also large parts of land, wanted the Jews to come. He sent boats to Spain to pick them up. He needed them because it says here, he needed artisans. Artisans means smiths and makers of firearms for the war against Christian Europe. He needed them to work in his factories, basically. He took 90,000 Jews, and he settled them in Turkey, mainly. They also went to Greece. Salonika was famous. They went to other places in Europe. We're not talking about that now. I just want to talk about the Turkish part. Turkey was becoming a very strong force, and they also had conquered many, many lands, and they needed people to settle. Turkey needed people to settle in their paths that went in various places to pick up, goods and things. One of the paths went down from Lebanon into Israel and went to Sfat, stopped at Sfat, and then went off to the coast. That's why many Jews, and we're going to talk about that shortly, ended up in Sfat, because on the roadway for the economics, the Turkish Sultan needed to put people there in order to develop it and have people keep it safe, basically. Sfat was not developed because we all like to think because it was so pretty, it was so holy, it was so anything. It was so economical. And that's fine. No one can argue. But that's why they ended up there. One of the famous people who exiled himself, who was exiled from Spain, was named Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch. Yosef Karo was 8 years old. He was taken in one of those boats and exiled off to Turkey. It was first Salonika, then Turkey, and then Sfat. We'll talk about him shortly. So now you know a little bit about the historic journey where they were sent over and they were given these 3 months to leave. But why? Why have them leave? What were they doing wrong there? Remember, when the Christians came in to Spain and took over parts of Spain, they wanted everybody to become Christian. So many of the Jews became the famous conversos, the Maranos, and they became Christian, let's call it. But we're well aware that many, many of those people did not feel comfortable becoming Christian, really, and maintained very much of their Jewish identity hidden. I'm sure some people here even know people that actually descend from that time. There's some famous kind of conversos today. And the converso legend about what happened, how they maintained their identity, what they did in private, what they did in secret, is actually still secret. Because they didn't tell anybody. They couldn't tell anybody. They didn't write this down. They were hiding what happened, what they needed to do. But so they're staying in Spain now, and they're Christian, but they're not. So what are we going to do about that? What is Ferdinand and Isabella and all the Christian kind of inquisitors, they don't like it. Because the Jews there who converted are not real converts. So are they Christian or are they Jewish? And really, where do you bury them? That was a big trauma for these people. Where should you bury them? Should you bury them in the Christian cemetery, or should you bury them in the Jewish cemetery? And if you think that is a small issue, you're wrong. People were very concerned about this matter. So they said, who are these people? Are they Jewish or are they Christian? We know on the outside that they're Christian. They're socializing with us, they're dealing with us, but we know also there's something hidden about them that's different. And they were very, very conflicted. The Jews, of course, themselves were very conflicted, but the Spanish people didn't know what to do. So I'm going to read you a passage from the Edict of Expulsion from the Spanish side. We read a Jewish account. And now we're going to read the Spanish side, and it's going to give a reason or a justification for the expulsion. You have to know historically that a government has to produce edicts. They can give you an edict to settle in a land, and they can give you they will produce an edict to have you expelled. You can't just say, all right, we'll throw them out, or will take away their passports. They had to do it in a semi-official kind of way, producing documents. These documents were very important for these people, and they would put them in the archives, and that's why we have them today. Because they wanted to keep them there just in case anybody said, excuse me, you have no legal justification, and they said, well, yes, we do. We put the edict of expulsion in the archives. That was a major event for them, and that's why we have this very important and interesting literature that discusses the expulsion in a kind of scientific way, I guess you could say, or a legal way. So I'm going to read you a little bit about the expulsion and what they said, why they wanted to get rid of these people. It appears from the way that they write that the Jews were having too much interaction with the Christians. Jews, by Jews I mean conversos, were having too much interaction with the bona fide Christians, and they were kind of converting them. The Christians at this point were having some very serious difficulties with their religion, very serious. It comes out in a lot of literature, like when you read in Chaucer. Remember that from a long time ago? Very few people read Chaucer today. And he makes fun of all the Christian ritual because they were having a lot of difficulties. So therefore, Christians were looking to other religions. And one of them happened to be Judaism. And they were, and these conversos were the perfect conduit in which to bring the Judaism to these Christians. And so this is what it says. We are going to expel them because the Jews, and they use this term, are Judaizing, missionizing, and they're taking away our Christians. Many Christians, it writes here in the edict, have engaged and continue to engage in social, in interaction and communication with these Jews. And the Jews subvert our faith and they steal faithful Christians from our holy Catholic faith and they separate the Christians from the faith. And the Jews instruct these Christians in the ceremonies and observances of their law, hold meetings at which they read and teach that which people must hold and believe according to their halacha, tell the Christians they must be circumcised, give these Christians books from which they may read and also teach them how to read the prayers, tell them about the fasts that they have to keep, and teach them all about their history, indicating to them all their festivals and yontifs. It goes on and on and on. Basically, they're training the Christians how to be Jews. And guess what? The Christians loved it. They must have. They must have been doing it in droves. When a religion is starting to wane, they look for something else. We saw this happening perfectly in the first century. In the first century, in the time of this, the Churban Beit Sheni, the Second Temple, and its destruction, many of the Jews were missionizing and were teaching pagans how to be Jewish because the pagan religion was on the wane and they didn't like it. Can you imagine? This is what one of the Greeks wrote. Augustus Caesar, right? The first emperor, Augustus Caesar, loved Judaism. He loved to keep the Sabbath and the fast days. I don't know what that means. Why would he love the fast? Anyways, whatever. You can't argue with history. So he loved, and the historian goes on and on and on, explaining how Augustus Caesar, of all people, head of the Roman Empire, right, loves being Jewish. It's not in our text. It's in theirs. And this became a very big problem, as it did in Spain. It always becomes a problem. It's a problem not because of us, really. It's because their own religion isn't offering them enough. So they turn to someone else, and it happened to be us. It was us in the first century, and it's us here in the 14th. So they taught them everything. They ate kosher food. You can't imagine. They ate kosher food, and they became Jewish, and they kept Yontif, and they started to learn about Shabbos and different languages. And it was successful. So all of a sudden, these conversos, who are supposed to be not Jewish at all, are creating tremendous trauma for them, because these conversos are the ones that can get involved with Christian society. Because Christian society said, fine, we'll take you. You're one of us. And then in conversation and in communication, the Christians were losing. And Ferdinand, Isabella, and all their Christian folks were terrified. And they were very nervous because they saw that their religion was not doing what it needed to do. So it had to get rid of what they viewed as the dangers. That is one approach to the Inquisition. There are other approaches. Really, nobody knows for sure why they were expelled. Is it because, as I said before, they wanted to be buried, right, in the Christian cemetery? Was it because they were Judaizing and missionizing? Really, we don't know. Because this is a lot of justification, and we're not really sure. And so, they write this in the city of Granada, that the Jews must go, and 3 months later, they're gone. They take their things, that is to say, the Spaniards take their homes, their goods. The Jews tried to sell it off, and it was very difficult for them to do so at any kind of good price. They weren't supposed to take any of their belongings out of the land of Spain. They didn't want to leave the land of Spain. They had no interest in leaving, but it became too dangerous to stay. So they started to go to different places. So I want to close the book on that part of the history. We could go on for this for a long time, but there's other interesting things to do. And what I want to say, and really the heart of my talk, is not about the history of the Inquisition, which was a very big problem and a horror story really for us and for Spain. But really, what happened was very interesting and very healthy in a way, is that the Jews, because they're able to sort of, assimilate wherever they are and take what they need to take and continue to be Jews, were able to do it in the expulsion. So they take what they had in Spain with them, all their learning, all their Torah, and they take it to Turkey and then to Sfat, and they turn it into something very, very unusual. So what I want to turn to now is the famous Zohar and Kabbalah that was developed. Actually, we don't know when it was developed. Again, another, I don't know, but what can I do? I'm only a reader. I wasn't there. And the history of the development of the mysticism is actually very, very difficult and not easy to figure out. But we don't need to do that. What we need to do is say, what happened in Spain? And what happened in Spain is the following question. And this is the biggest question that we still wrestle with today, is how do I bridge the world, how do I bridge myself and God? How do I bridge that relationship? What do I do? Do I pray? Do I do mitzvahs? Do I do nothing? Do I do sort of something? Do I eat this? Do I not eat this? Am I nice to people? Am I not nice? How am I going to make that bridge? Because The problem is a problem that started many, many years ago. But we want God, and we see God as being transcendent, removed from our world, right? We're here, God's not really here, we're here. On the other hand, we want a personal connection to God. We need a personal connection to Hashem, to feel Jewish, to feel connected, to feel loved, and to give love, both. So how do you do it? This, I know, is not really the forum for it. I only have like 20 minutes left. But really, it's very exciting. Because when you think, that's what I want to do, I just want to bridge. I just want to make that connection. How do I do it? What are the ways to do it? Every way seems rife with problems. Let's say we say like this. God is supposed to be all in our world. God is supposed to be everywhere here. And the mystics already thought about this in Spain. All right, so he's supposed to be everywhere. Well, guess what? If he's everywhere, you're not here. Okay, that's a problem. That's a problem for me. Because at 9:08, I want to eat. No, but what I'm telling you is we can't have both. I can't have God inhabiting, and I can't have myself inhabiting. So God has to leave. And if God leaves, so what does that say? Now where am I? Where are we? This whole idea of God being transcendent and immanent was an idea already that went back to the first century, second century, a long time ago. But the mystics in Spain and eventually in Sfat take this on like wildfire. This is such a problem for them. And probably part of it is from the Inquisition. We thought we had God in Spain, right? We thought we had God holding onto us, us holding onto God. We had philosophy there and Kabbalah there. All of a sudden, we're not there. So then how come God is breaking the bridge? What for? What did we do? What did we do wrong? These were big problems that they went through. So they came up with some very interesting approaches. I don't know how much you know about Kabbalah, but it goes like this. The relationship between God and us is one that is activated through something called the Sfirot. The Sfirot are like, let's call them eminences of God, aspects of God. So when I do something, a good deed, a something, it triggers one of those things, which then goes up to God, and God then, in turn, rains down love and health on me, or us. This is simple. I'm simplifying, I agree, but we're just doing this, you know, in light of the fact that we don't have that much time. So here it is, that we can connect to God through these Sfirot, vessels. And that's the way that mysticism understands it. When you do something, the effect has to touch Hashem. But it has to touch Hashem in a way that's like kind of communal. You do a mitzvah, it goes through these things, it touches God, God then rains down something on us. It's a kind of a system, it's a procedural system, it's not that individual, because it also means that there's a system there that you have to link into, and it's basically a lot of connectors that are going going into to God. Now, what happens, and what I'm gonna, this is really the next part, what happens in Turkey, in Sfas, is something very different. All of a sudden, the individual is being seen as the one that is important. The individual soul is being developed. And that's very interesting for us, because honestly, we like the individual. We're more comfortable with the individual. We have a problem with saying, yes, I'm part of this community, but I'm also an individual. Since the Enlightenment, the individual has taken front ranks. It wasn't like that before. The world changed. It changed dramatically. So what happened in when we take our mysticism over to Turkey and out of Spain, things change dramatically. And I want to read you something very beautiful, which happened through one of the masters of Kabbalah, not so much in, a little bit after Svat, the Kedushas Levi, Berdichever, and he talks about something that is very, very interesting. Watch how this goes. Remember in Exodus, in Shemot, in Perek Beit, it says that Moses, right, Moshe was in a little bulrush, and his sister Miriam had to take him to the bulrush to save him from the decree of Pharaoh. And she stood by watching, and the text says, his sister stood by from afar to know what was going to befall him. Okay, we all know that, it's all cute. Then the daughter of Paro comes out and whatever, however she gets it, she brings him in, and the rest is biblical history. But it says there, v'titatsev achoto merachok, the sister, doesn't say Miriam, it says his sister stands from afar to know what's going to happen. Okay, seems simple. She's a little bit, right, hiding in the bulrushes, which are very tall, and she's nervous about what's going to happen to him because who knows, and she wants to be able to tell her mother, who told her, instructed her to do this, that everything is fine. It's just a simple reading. But no, 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 says mysticism. They don't say that. What they do is something very, very different. They bring the soul into this, and I'm going to show you what this text does with this. To me, this is mind-blowing. I love reading this. I love reading this kind of commentary. He takes something so simple and does something very different. And I'll read it to you and then explain it to you. He says like this, why does it have to say in the text, mirachok, that she stood afar? All right, like really, why not? It seems good, it seems healthy, she wants to be safe, she wants to find out what's going on. But the Berdichever doesn't like that. And he gives a long explanation. And he says, our world is mired in gashmias, in materialism. And when we're mired in materialism, we're not able to find out really what God wants us to do. We can't tell. We have no, we don't know. We get sidetracked. We get bored. We don't know what God wants us to do. So then we lose the connection. Remember, this is all about a bridge. We lose the connection between ourselves and God. So he says like this, why does it have to say she stood afar? Meaning, she stood afar from the materialistic world. She stands away from the gashmias. Miriam understood that she's going to stand away from the stuff that's no good. And she's going to be able to find out what happened. It doesn't just say what happened to poor Moshe. It says, L'de'a maya selo, to find out, to know through a kind of holy knowledge, says the Kabbalah, says the mysticism, through a holy knowledge, what happened to Moshe. And then, you don't have to do all that. Basically, that's the story. The word from afar is perfect for mystics. Don't get too close. Don't get too involved. When you're too involved in gushmias and materialism, you don't see anything clearly. You don't understand yourself. You don't understand God. You don't know what's going to happen. So the mystic here is saying that word there in the Torah is perfect. It's to show the brilliance of Miriam, the brilliance of her understanding of the world, her relationship to God, and how she is going to figure out what happened. Not just she'll look around and she'll see Pharaoh's daughter come and take her out. You know, all the things we know from the movies. No. She has to really know. The word in here is lidea, to know, the knowledge. Knowledge for the mystic is the knowledge of God. So this way of interpreting, this simple line that you never thought twice of, is genius. It's mystical. Thank you for that nice little music. It's mystical. It's maybe not coming from here. It's mystical, and it's unusual. That's what happened to mysticism. It says like this: I've got to make a connection with God, because I want the bridge to be restored. Yes, I was exiled, but I'm going to go into the land. I'm going to go, and I'm going to still maintain it. We as Jews, especially on Tisha B'Av, when we talk about rupture, destruction, finished, over, we want to build the bridge again. And that's precisely what the mystics did. I'll finish off with something that everybody knows very well, Lecha Dodi. Lecha Dodi, the song you sing on Friday night, is a song that came from Spain. There were 20 versions of Lecha Dodi. How this hit the hit parade, I don't know. But there were a lot of versions, and they were all a little different. They were written by mystics. It's a totally mystical experience. When you sing this song, it is the mystical experience of the ages. Let's just look at some of it. So, there's a famous midrash that says, the world was created where everybody in the world, every aspect of the world, had a partner. The first and the second day, the third and the fourth day, the fifth and the sixth day, and the seventh day, alas, Shabbat, was empty. Had no partner, had no friend, whatever. Had nobody to play with in the playground. It's not good. So the Midrash says from a long time ago, from the time of Hillel already, says, who is the partner to Shabbat? The community. Okay, that's well known. Everybody talks about it. It's interesting actually on its own, not for us now, but it's interesting. So Shabbat has no partner. So the partner is you, me. And when we sing, come Shabbat, come to us, we're getting married because we're the partner, right? Every day at a partner, we're the partner. So every time on Friday night when you sing the song, or even if you don't, you're making the bridge. Again, the bridge is so vital. The bridge of bringing in Shabbat, making it your own. That's famous, famous, famous midrash from a long time ago. But what did they do in the song Lecha Dodi, in the mystic song? It says, starts off, come out, my beloved, the bride, go meet her. The inner light of Shabbat, let's greet her. That's what they're saying. Okay. What happened in the day of when the Sfat mystics, what they did was they put on white gowns and they physically went to the fields to meet Shabbat. Let's go meet her. It says we have to go make our union, make our bridge. Let's do it physically. It's a famous thing. It's well known. They went out to meet her. Whoever did it, we're not sure who did it. The Arizal for sure did it. Cordovero, some other ones probably did it too. Doesn't make a difference. The history is that they did it. And why did they do it? They did it because now the mystic world is saying to you, you, individual, need to create this new bridge with God. We no longer have these communities. We're all spread out all over the place. We're in Svat. There weren't that many of them. This place, that place, Amsterdam, this place, that place. And you know what? If I, as an individual, don't make my mark and create my unity with God, I can't do. This religion is over. So the mystics wanted to say, and in the Chad-Dodi you see it beautifully, let's go physically meet Shabbat. It doesn't really make sense to you. You're going to meet Shabbat? What are you talking about? This is like, anthropomorphism at its best. It doesn't make sense. But they didn't see it that way. They wanted you individuals, me, all of us, to bring Shabbat in, to make the union, and to make the bridge. There's absolutely, that is the only way to see this piece. Many people have done beautiful studies on the Chad-Dodi, because it's so meaningful. But the main thing, the big picture is, that what happened to mysticism, the journey of mysticism, started off in a community and went through many, many, many avenues and trials and almost loss, I would have to say, but then was sort of reunited with the self. And that was very unusual. And Judaism started to look at the self as important before the Enlightenment. Historically, you have to jump out of your seats. Okay, you're a little tired. It's a little much, but you should jump out of your seats. We did it. We talked about the self, whether it's with Miriam in understanding her role as wanting to find out what happened with the whole God world. She stands from afar. Right? She shakes the bonds of materialism. It's perfect. It's really perfect. And that's what the mystics did. And that's why I called this talk A Mystical Journey. When I started off with the famous, famous, famous piece from the Baal Shem, and where he only would daven if his people were there. And when they were there, what does he say in the piece? He says, the ladder crumbled, the bridge crumbled. I don't have it. I can't do it. If you're not with me, if you're not together, if we're not all holding this bridge up together, I can't do it. And I'm the Baal Shem Tov. If he can't do it, then how can I do it? So I think in thinking about Tisha B'Av, a time of total destruction. Destruction in every way. Destruction with the spies. Destruction with the golden calf. Destruction with everything. That we have to see that we're on a different journey. And the different journeys are the bridge with God, and that's fine. I just heard this morning a wonderful talk from YU by J.J. Schachter, who said, the letter Samach in Hebrew, which is round, is nowhere found in the creation story. And the reason why he said that is because the roundness of a letter is the worst type of story to go through. If you start and grow through somewhere and then end off in the same spot, no, you haven't done well. You can't keep doing cyclical things. You know how we always do the same things, we do the same mistakes, we eat the same bad food, you know all that. So we don't want to do that. We want to be linear. We want to be different. We want to break the bonds of the circles and somehow develop differently. And that's what I think you see in mysticism. You see it in other things too, but I wanted today in my talk to give you some, honestly, some nice ways of looking at creating that bond that was broken or that almost seemed broken. With that, I close.